Chapter 40. Gavin tore off the stained shirt and grunted as he scraped the cloth across his burn. 50 dinar shirt, and I ruined it in half an hour. Worse, he'd noticed some of the girls glancing at the spreading stain. That wasn't a disaster. They wouldn't ask about it. One of the Spectrum would. He liked to save up his lies for them. He cursed under his breath. Gavin knew that Maricia must have some sort of an organizational scheme to how she put away his clothing, but whatever it was, he'd never pierced its logic. He rifled through stacks of shirts and pants and breeches and cloaks and abiyas and robes and thobes and pethasoi and gotras, most of which he didn't think he'd ever worn. Or Hollum, he had a lot of clothes, and these were only his summer clothes. He supposed it was because, as Prism, he was supposed to be of all peoples. So if he met with an ambassador or needed to suddenly visit a Bornea, he would already have local clothing that fit him. He was still standing, bare-chested, ointment smeared on his burn. At least he had the sense to keep aid supplies in his own room when the door opened. Maricia slipped in quietly. She glanced at the burn on his ribs. Her jade-green eyes lit with anger, though Gavin couldn't tell if it was at him or for him. Maybe a bit of both. She grabbed the ointment from his table and smeared more around to his back. Ouch. Apparently he'd missed some spots. Then she bandaged him with a practiced hand. She wasn't gentle. "Does my lord need assistance finding another shirt?" she asked.
"Ow!"
he yelped. He cleared his throat, lowered his voice an octave. "Please." She went to a stack he swore he'd searched thoroughly and immediately plucked a shirt from its depths. He didn't think he'd ever worn it before, but it was a style he liked, and dark enough that if the ointment soaked through this one, no one would notice. Maricia had a certain magic of her own. He could swear that shirt hadn't been there before. She began whistling quietly as she dressed him and fixed his hair. It was an old tune. Pretty. Maricia was a good whistler. Oh, the tune was Little Lamb Lost. A comment on not being able to find his own clothes? Probably. He had bigger things to worry about. He'd dealt with his brother. How much trouble could the Spectrum be? "I'll be leaving either in the morning or the next day," Gavin said. "There's a young man testing downstairs. Kip. He's my, natural son." There was no need to use the nephew euphemism with Maricia. Maricia knew that Gavin had imprisoned his brother, but even she didn't know that Gavin wasn't Gavin. She hadn't known either of them before the war, so she didn't need to know. He trusted her completely, but the fewer people who knew that secret, the longer it would be before all this crashed down on his head. "He's 16. 15, I mean. Will you find appropriate clothes for him and pack for both of us for 2 weeks?"
"More for fighting or for impressing?"
"Both."
"Of course," she said flatly.
On his way out the door, Gavin grabbed his sword in its jeweled scabbard. It wasn't nearly the hand with a blade that even the least of the blackguard was. He had been quite skilled once, but once he'd realized he could draft any combination of color and instantly have a weapon of whatever kind he needed, he hadn't practiced with plain steel as often as was required to compete with professional warriors like the blackguard. Of course, that assumed a fair fight, and there was no such thing with a drafter. The blackguards themselves would fight with whatever was at hand, blades, magic, a goblet of wine, or a face full of sand. He tucked the Elysian pistols into his belt too, just to be an ass. When Gavin stepped out of his door, there were two blackguards waiting for him. His escort. It was his compromise with the white. He got to travel without the blackguard when he thought it was absolutely necessary, so most of the time, as long as he agreed to have them around when he was in a place where assassination was more likely. The white wasn't pleased with how he'd interpreted their agreement, but he clung ferociously to what little freedom he had. He strode quickly through the single hall that separated the halves of this level. He and the white each had one half of the floor. Because of the Chromeria's rotation, Gavin's half was always pointed toward the sun. An odd irony that the white should be forever in shadow, though in her elder years this white had appreciated it. It minimized the temptations of drafting and hastening her own death. Gavin wondered again how she did it. Without drafting, he would feel empty, weak. Life wouldn't be worth living without chromaturgy. It defined who he was. Surely it had done the same for the white, and yet she lived on, her will still iron, her back unbowed. Stepping past the blackguards guarding her room, he knocked on her door. "She's not here," the man on the left said. "The white has gone to meet with a Chromeria. She thought it would be rude to keep the full spectrum waiting because of one man's tardiness." This was how the blackguards registered their displeasure. His own blackguards knew where he was going as soon as he turned toward the white's room rather than toward the lift, but they didn't tell him. The white's blackguards knew where he was going as soon as they saw him, but they didn't tell him the white was gone until he knocked, causing him to waste more time and be even later. One man's tardiness? What's the spectrum going to talk about without me? I called the meeting. As was typical, the blackguards were careful in showing their irritation. There would be no more trouble from them for a while. Iron Fist would see to that. If they peeved Gavin more than occasionally, he would do more to avoid them, and they wouldn't be able to do their job of protecting him. Still, they wanted him to respect them, which he did, after a fashion. It's an odd person who volunteers to jump in front of an arrow when they don't even know if they'll like the prism or white that they'll be assigned to guard. But he wouldn't be chained. Power was freedom. Power had to be maintained. "If you can't serve me well," Gavin said to his own two blackguards, "you can't serve me at all." He turned on his heel and started walking toward the lift. Of course they said nothing. They simply accompanied him on his left and right. Commander Iron Fist trained them to ignore orders that put their charges in danger. Gavin waved his arms down, drafting bars of blue Luxin strengthened with yellow down to his left and right. His blackguards hesitated momentarily as he kept walking briskly, and he closed the gap in the middle. He kept walking, not even looking back, as he threw up walls of solid blue, red, green, yellow, and superviolet. It satisfied a small part of him. His brother really had gotten under his skin. The bastard. But at the same time, this was necessary. The blackguard had to know they couldn't control him. That was how smart bodyguards worked. Impede your freedom a little, then a little more, and soon they had their way. Gavin wasn't going to let that happen. If he had the blackguard hovering around him at all times, as they ultimately wished, they would learn not just his secrets like the skimmer and the condor, but his final secret. What would the blackguard do if they found out that Gavin wasn't Gavin at all? They might decide he was the de facto prism, and that was enough. Or they might decide he was a threat to the real prism. Or he might split the blackguard into warring camps. Pleasant thought. A bunch of elite warrior drafters trying to destroy each other. That was what made this necessary. The blackguard must be taught and taught again to accept the crumbs Gavin let drop. "You can protect me if you serve me wholeheartedly, and I'll withdraw that privilege when I please, for any reason or none." At first, years ago, Commander Spear had punished those blackguards who let Gavin escape them. When that didn't work, he'd made the punishments public, shaming the blackguards for that which wasn't their fault. Gavin had felt awful, and had not changed a bit. Commander Spear had escalated the punishments, publicly flogging several men, including a young Iron Fist. Gavin had responded by yawning and not letting any blackguards near him for a month. Then he'd walked through crowded markets, leaving bound and gagged the blackguards that Commander Spear sent, and he'd done it in the aftermath of the war, when there had been not a few men who would have gladly killed him. When there finally was an assassination attempt and no blackguards present, Commander Spear had discharged the six blackguards who were supposed to be protecting Gavin. The white had finally stepped in and discharged Commander Spear instead. Gavin hadn't felt sorry for the man. Once he'd learned that using Gavin's guilt against him wouldn't work, he should have tried something else. A man who couldn't change tactics shouldn't be in charge of the blackguard in the first place. The move hadn't made Gavin any friends, but it had left him in charge. Besides, he didn't need friends. The two blackguards at the lift looked at each other as he approached. The woman on the left was short but as thick as a bull. She said, "High Lord Prism, I notice you don't have an escort. May I join you?" Gavin grinned. "Since you ask so nicely," he said. They opened the lift for him, and in moments he was on the next level below his and the White's floor. The blackguards on watch blinked at his sole escort. Doubtless they knew the guard rotation and knew she wasn't supposed to be on prism duty, nor was the prism supposed to be guarded by only one blackguard. "High Lord Prism," one of them said, a tall red-orange bichrome youth, only 20 years old, thus quite talented. "May I accompany you?" "Thank you, but no," Gavin said. "You can't protect me from what's waiting here." Gavin had told Kip that the White tried to balance the prism's power, but he didn't like it much when she did. He stepped into the council room. The colours were scattered around the table. For formal events, they would sit in order around the table: sub-red, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, super-violet, black, prism, white. For meetings like this one, however, the pull of sitting by friends, or the lure of grabbing one of the more comfortable chairs, outweighed the natural tendency to sit in the same spot every time. Gavin found the last spot between the super-violet, a tall, skin-and-bones, coal-black Parian woman named Sada, and the soft, lighter-skinned Hrothgari man with the beaded beard, Clytos Blue. Gavin had told Kip that each colour represented a country, and that was mostly true. Each satrap or satrapa appointed one colour. It was the most important decision most rulers ever made, but the system had begun to break down even before the False Prism's War, when Andros Guile had bribed and blackmailed his way into the red seat, though the Blood Forest already had one colour. He'd been so audacious he'd stolen that seat from Hrothgar, claiming that the Giles' sliver of swampland in Hrothgari made him eligible for the Hrothgari seat. Of course, after the war, similar logic had been used to deprive Tyria of a seat. There were so many interlocking and overlapping layers of loyalty, it was dizzying. Both the red and the green were Hrothgari, and thus likely to unite on any issue concerning Hrothgar. But the green was also cousins with Giatolva, an Abornian woman who was the yellow. The Abornians strangled both Parian and Hrothgari trade through the Narrows, so anything to do with trade would see them at each other's throats, but on anything else they might try to form a block. The sub-red was a Blood Forester who were allies now with their stronger neighbours, the Hrothgari, but her parents had been killed in the war by the Green's brothers. And on it went. Every noble family in the Seven Satrapies did everything it could to get at least one son or daughter into the Chromeria, if for nothing else than to try to watch their backs. In turn, everyone in the Spectrum did all they could to protect themselves. Family bonds, clan bonds, national bonds, colour bonds, and ideological bonds cut every which way. The colours were political creatures as much as they were magical. To be named a colour took a certain amount of chromaturgical aptitude. The White saw to that. But after that bar was reached, not a few of these seats had found inhabitants at the same time that donkey trains loaded with gold had made their way into royal houses. Gavin knew it had been thus when his own father had joined. The White, in her wheeled chair, said, "I call this meeting to order. Let the record show that all colours except for red are in attendance." They hated that. Hated that they couldn't get rid of Andros Guile. They hated that in defiance of all convention, he hadn't attended a meeting in 5 years, but still insisted that his votes be counted. They hated what his having his vote delivered by messenger said about how little he valued their opinions. No eloquence would ever move Andros Guile. He would see and weigh every issue alone, and decide, regardless of the mummery of these Spectrum meetings. But they feared him too. The White said, "Lord Prism, you have called this meeting, so I turn over the proceeding to you." She thought she was thwarting him, that he'd grown too independent, that he might become dangerous if she didn't yank the leash. Careful, Aurea. When choked, dogs go docile, but wolves go wild. Gavin's relationship with the Spectrum had always been thorny. Of course, when he'd been recuperating after Sundered Rock, they'd stripped him of his title of Promarchos, taking control of the armies away from him as custom dictated, but they also hadn't known whether he would allow it. Still learning his new guise, he had, but he didn't care much for any of the colours personally, nor did they care for him. He'd lived
too long, become too powerful. He didn't need them, and that scared them. They hated his father. They hated the Giles, and they stymied Gavin whenever they could. Patience, Gavin. Plenty of time for Purpose 6. Plenty of room to manoeuvre. You are Andros Giles' son.
We need to release the city of Garriston immediately. Pull out all of our men and give it back to King Hardul, Gavin said. Preferably with an apology that we didn't do it sooner.
Silence. Followed by awkward silence. Clytos Blue chuckled uncertainly. When no one else joined him, he fell silent.
King? The White asked.
That's what he's calling himself.
Gavin didn't elaborate.
Sada Superviolet said,
Surely you're not serious, Lord Prism. The governorship transfers to Perea in a few weeks. It's our right. People have made plans. Ships are sailing already. If we must have this conversation, let us have it in 2 years from now.
Absolutely not, Delara Orange said.
She was a 40-year-old bichrome with great sagging breasts and the red and orange in her eyes pushing to the very edge of her irises. She was Natashian. Atash got the governorship right after Perea's.
Perea took the very first rotation when there were actually a few treasures left in the city, and you looted it all.
We also had to repair a city that had been burned to the ground and care for its injured and ill. We took only what was appropriate recompense.
Stop, Gavin said, before it could go any further. You're having the wrong fight. This isn't about who has the governorship, in what order, or for how long. It's been 16 years since we crushed Tyria. They still don't have a representative in this room. There are fewer Tyrians in the Chromeria every year. Why is that? Have they suddenly stopped bearing drafters there? Or is it because we have demanded a tribute from them so ruinous they can't support their drafters, which in turn impoverishes their land further? Then we hold Garriston, their main port and their largest city, and your governors tax every orange and pomegranate and melon. I've been to Garriston, and it's a shadow of its former greatness. The great irrigation canals are full of sand. The fields are worked by women and children, or no one, and there's not a drafter to be found.
You pity them? Delara Orange asked.
When my brothers rise from the dead and the castle of Rue is rebuilt, I'll feel pity for Garriston. They joined Daeson. It was their war that killed tens of thousands. I saw them cast Satrapa Nahid's 2-year-old son down the great steps. I saw them cut open her pregnant belly, take her babe, and make bets on how far down the steps one of their men could throw the screaming child. They cut off the satrapa's nose and ears and breast and arms and legs and threw her down after, while we watched.
The babe made it all the way to the last step, in case you're curious. I got some of its brains on my dress. I wanted to try to catch it, but I didn't move. No one did. Those are the people you wish us to have mercy on. Or maybe it's the people who sank the entire refugee flotilla, which had not a single drafter or armed man on board.
That was Gavin's fault, as Daeson. He sent a young, new general, Gad Delmata. Had all this been efficient and direct? Gavin had told Gad to secure Rue. General Delmata had taken that to mean to secure it so there could never be any resistance ever again. He'd exterminated the royal family, all 56 members of it and scores of their male retainers, publicly, one at a time, in the order of their succession, and burned down their great castle, the pride of Atash. When the people had fled, General Delmata had sent fire drafters after the flotilla. Gavin had only found out about it afterward. And then what could he do? It was war, and his general had followed his orders. And when General Delmata marched on the great city of Eidos next, it had surrendered without a fight because of their fear of the man, because of his cruelty.
Maybe, Gavin said, we could count how many children died when you burned Garriston in retaliation and barred the gates so no one could escape.
I seem to recall that all the Tyrian drafters and all but 200 of the Tyrian soldiers were 100 leagues away at the time. How long did it take for the river to clear of bodies? So many little corpses bobbing in the water. Even with all those hundreds of sharks turning the bay to bloody foam with their thrashing, it was weeks, wasn't it?
Gavin had never learned whose idea it was, but when Garriston had been burned, someone had stationed red drafters all around the walls. Soldiers shielded the drafters while they hurled red Luxin back and forth in swathes throughout the city.
Red Luxin was used as fuel for lamps. Spread throughout a city, it had made a hell for the residents of Garrison. Tens of thousands had jumped into the river, and thousands more had jumped in on top of them. Their bodies themselves had almost been enough to dam the river in places, and then some of his older brothers, cleverer drafters, had floated Red Luxin down the river in little boats of green or blue Luxin, or mixed red and orange Luxin to make a concoction so flammable it would burn even under water, or mixed it with superviolet to make it float, burning on the very water itself. Between the fire, the smoke, the water, the press of the crowds, the crushing deaths as whole buildings fell into the packed river, and the fire floating down the river itself, there had been death on a scale no one had imagined before. Before the war, Garrison had been home to more than 100,000 people. His own conscriptions had thinned that to perhaps 80,000. After the fires, only 10,000 remained. And after the first winter, only 5,000.
"Enough," the black said.
Carver was no drafter, and so in some respects he was the weakest member of the spectrum. As the black, he was responsible for most of the mundane aspects of ruling Little Jasper, importing food, managing trade, awarding contracts, recruiting and paying soldiers, maintenance for buildings and the docks, building ships and everything else that the white ceded to his control so she could focus on managing the Chromeria itself. But he was a formidable man, and Gavin respected him.
"We could list horrors all day, Lord Prism. What's the point?"
"The point is, out of my 5 great purposes left, the only purely altruistic one is to free Garrison. Those people are suffering because of me, and you bastards have stopped every attempt I've made to help them." "The point is," Gavin said, "that the Tyrians have as much reason to hate us as we have to hate them. We've been punishing them for the war for 16 years. Most of the people paying the price now were children when the war started. They see no reason they should continue paying for what their dead fathers did or didn't do. They hate us, and the fact is, none of us, none of the 7 satrapies, want to go back there with an army."
"What are you saying?"
Luxlord Black asked.
"Do you have specific intelligence of a threat?"
"I'm saying if we don't pull out of Garrison and end the tribute on our terms, King Haradul is going to take Garrison by force and end it on his." That's what King Haradul had meant when he'd told Gavin, "We're going to take back what you stole from us." But Gavin couldn't tell them about that without revealing more secrets, and they wouldn't believe it anyway.
"I'm failing to see the humor here," Clytos Blue said nervously. He was a coward in a dozen ways, but Hrothgar wasn't going to give up Garrison easily, Gavin knew. "We've got 1,000 soldiers and 50 drafters there. The drafters alone could hold off whatever army this King Haradul could raise. Knuckling under to a rebel, a man who declares himself a king. It's unthinkable," the orange said. "He deserves death."
"Oh, father, it's too bad you never come anymore. You would enjoy this. I can do one thing that you never could."
"First," Gavin said, "us leaving is the right thing to do. We're punishing people who have suffered too much already, and they hate us for it. We've been planting the seeds of another war for the last 16 years. They started the war, yes. General Del Mata was born in Garrison, yes. But that doesn't excuse us from what we've done, which is not just wrong, but also stupid."
"Excuse me?"
Delara Orange said. Her predecessor to the Orange, her mother, had been the architect of the rotating occupation scheme.
"You heard me," Gavin said. "We get almost no Tyrian drafters. You think that's because none are born there anymore?"
"Ha! What if, instead of training here, where they are poor and reviled and suspected as traitors, what if someone decided to train them closer to home? A new school, a Chromeria dedicated to vengeance, started because of our pettiness and stupidity."
"Nonsense," Delara said. "We would have heard of such a thing."
"But what if you hadn't?" Gavin asked. "The quality of instruction might not be as good as ours. I hope it wouldn't be. But even with a few rudimentary fire spells, how long could your 50 drafters stationed in Garrison hold out against several hundred? How long could your soldiers hold out against thousands of rebels who could hide in plain sight among the locals? The fact is, King Haradul will take Garrison. He will demand it on terms that he knows are insufferable, and then he will seize it.
The only question is, will we lose and lose face and make King Charadul seem like a winner and finally get drawn into a war your satrapies don't have the stomach for, or will we forego a tribute which, after it's divided six ways, is insignificant, and give away that which we can't keep? If we give garrison to King Charadul before he even asks, we look magnanimous. If we give him an apology, we look moral. And if we do both before he asks, we deprive him of a victory and a cause.
Do you have evidence of all this?
Dalara asked. She was slippery, as oranges tended to be. But drafting Red Luxon made a drafter more aggressive and reckless over time, too.
Because it seems to me that you would like us to give away an entire city for little reason otherwise. We don't know this new King Charadul. He has only recently taken power. He hasn't sent us a single emissary, much less made demands.
You're telling me none of you have spies at Charadul's side? Gavin shot back. A few sardonic smiles and silence. No one was going to admit that, of course. They didn't trust each other enough. There had been no wars in the last 16 years, but that didn't mean that everyone's interests were aligned. The Chromeria and every capital was as full of spies as it had ever been. If you don't, Gavin said, in an imperious tone sure to needle them, get some.
High Lux, Lord, we take your advice to the satrapies very seriously, of course, Clytos Blue started to say.
The Hrothgari hated Gavin, and had since he'd ended the war with the Blood Forest. Gavin cut him off. Time to play the hothead. Listen, you morons. I don't know how you didn't see this coming. Or maybe some of you did. Your loyalty is noted. The fact remains this is rebellion, and it's heresy. King Charadul is talking about overthrowing the satrapies and the worship of Orholm himself. I would have thought Orholm would command better service from his colours.
Enough! Enough, Lord Prism! The White barked.
She looked at Gavin like she couldn't believe what he'd said. Nothing like calling powerful men and women idiots, ingrates, disloyal and impious all at once. Looking around the room, Gavin saw shock on some faces and hatred on others. In the silence, Clytos Blue spoke first. He was a Blue. It was only natural he should think things through faster than anyone else.
I believe that we should take the Lord Prism seriously. It's only prudent that we serve the satrapies and Orholm as zealously as he does every day.
The words were delivered straight, but the malice couldn't have been more evident.
I move that we send a delegation to Garriston to assess the threat from the alleged rebel Charadul and report back to us directly.
A delegation? Are you blind or stupid or corrupt? Gavin demanded.
By the time that Gavin, the White said, enough!
She took the vote for a delegation to be sent and report back in 2 months' time. It passed, 5-0, with 2 abstentions. Gavin sat back in his chair as if stunned, defeated. In the silence, before anyone stood to leave, he shook his head. Said grimly, I ceded power after the war, gave up the Promachia. I became an advisor when many wanted me to be an emperor in truth. And now you ignore me. Very well. But tell your satraps and satrapers this. Prepare for war. King Charadul won't stop at taking Garriston. I guarantee it. You see, Father, this is the one thing I can do that you never could. I can handle appearing to lose.